girls gone, they literally, in a bikini, look like a wisdom tooth, don't they? All the shape and all that sort of stuff. So when people in real life can't actually look like that, straight away they're being made to feel... Do you know what I mean?
I identify because we've got a filter on this camera because obviously I'm ripped.
You know, of course. Ripped. And also the camera puts on pounds.
Yes, yeah, so we've got 74 cameras here. Welcome to Conversations with Nick Conn. Really good news for anyone that's watching that is still suffering with a cocaine addiction. Only 8 more sleeps till Christmas.
Oh, God. Wow.
Okay, so today, really excited. It's going to be a fun one. I've got Nathan King in the studio today. Nathan is in recovery. Great story. Very passionate about recovery. And I'm hoping we can kind of get some of that out there today. Welcome.
Nick, thank you ever so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. Very grateful.
Do you know what? It was worth it, though. 100% worth it.
I mean, of course it's going to be worth it. You know, you're here with me. You know, it's going to be worth
it. I've heard about these jokes and I can imagine they're going to keep coming. Go on.
They will. That's for sure. We can't guarantee we'll get people well, but we guarantee that we make people laugh.
Which is the most important thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm really interested because I've never had a chance to really know your story. So let's start with what was growing up like?
Right. Growing up for me was, I can't fault it. I really can't fault it. I had a really good upbringing, a very close, very loving family, 3 lovely sisters. I've got a mum and dad as well. And, you know, mum and dad always worked hard. I don't know what it was. I was bullied through secondary school. Primary school was always good for me, but secondary school, I started getting bullied.
Why do you think you were kind of victimised there?
I was, because I used to dance, I used to do a bit of modelling, and people didn't like that. So I used to get the whole, oh, you're gay, you must be, and all that. And obviously, when you're growing up, now obviously it's like water off a duck's back, but when I was growing up, sort of 13, 14 years old, and you're being picked on I was in quite a vulnerable thing anyway, because I've always been a very much a family guy and very close to my parents, very close to my sisters. And I always used to get very homesick. So even going to school, I felt very, very vulnerable.
Oh, wow.
Which
right.
is, yeah. So when you add to that people saying, you know, you're this, you're that, you're gay, you dance, you know, it really didn't help me at all. And I sort of started rebelling from, I would have said, about 13, 14 years old.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure it's because of that.
And you're quite musical as well, aren't you?
Yeah, I grew up around music. My dad worked with a band in the 70s. My mum sort of tinkered, nothing major, but she sort of tinkered with the piano. We've always had pianos and that in the house. Dad worked in entertainment in the music world for many years, like I say, with bands. Yeah, like music was a big escapism for me. From a young age, I had piano lessons at 11. I say piano lessons, I had one, but it got me in. You know, I'm really grateful for it because it got me into, you know, music really. And ever since then, I taught myself to play piano, taught myself to play guitar, and it's been an escape for me.
Because I can play actually a soundtrack on a piano.
You can you?
Yeah. What is that? I mean, I'm quite good at playing the Jaws soundtrack.
The
two keys.
Oh, yeah. That's quite technical, though.
It's hard, because you've got to get faster. But I've nailed it.
Have you got the speed now? Speed's up to date and all that?
Yeah, I'm getting older now, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
frail.
So, you know. Yes. So that's interesting. I mean, kids can be vicious. And I'm sure, I mean, especially now, you know, back in our day, it was one form of bullying. You know, you're face to face, you're at school. Whereas now they're getting it
nowadays
on TikTok, on Instagram, on social media platforms. You know, they're getting it all angles.
And also, not only that, like with the social media thing, like you say, like going back to our day, I'm not sure how, you know, why you're sort of tarnishing me with the same age as you, but we'll move on from that. I think, yeah, like you say, back that, you know, it was very much face to face. These were days before you had, pretty much before you had mobile phones. You used to have to go and knock on people's doors to see if they were coming out and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Nowadays, the obviously the trolling, the amount of abuse. I mean, just even I get loads of abuse online. I get it, because obviously it's based on what I'm doing with the raising awareness around addiction and mental health. I do understand that people don't want to see you sort of succeed, don't want to see you do well. So there is a lot of hate there, but I don't think as well with the social media, with making young people, young adults or children. What's making them vulnerable as well is the people online putting all this fake pictures, the pictures with all the filters on, making themselves look like, I mean, some girls go on there, they literally in a bikini look like a wisdom tooth, don't they? All the shape and all that sort of stuff. So when people in real life can't actually look like that, straight away they're being made to feel, do you know what I mean? Like,
I identify because we've got a filter on this camera because obviously, I'm ripped. You
know, yeah, of course. Yeah, now, yeah. Ripped. And also, the camera puts on pounds.
Yes,
yeah,
so we've got 74 cameras here.
Yeah.
So, because I don't want people feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah, of course.
You know?
Definitely.
So, you know, it's all
just add a bit of puppy
just
fat.
Always trying to help, you know. So, you left school. So, it was quite a traumatic time, I suppose, because, you know, what one person perceives as trauma, you know, is. It's all individual. Mm. It's all very personal. So you kind of finished school. What did you do after that?
During school, I had a lot of time off work. Off school, anyway. Good start. Yeah. I had a lot of time off school because of modelling. I did, like, there were some big campaigns that I'd done. And that didn't help me either, because I was being sort of I wasn't given special treatment. That's not what I mean. But because I was excused because that was going to be my career, that was what I was doing.
Okay.
So the school, there was I don't know what it's called now. It's probably all changed now. But back then there was an agreement, like my agent would have got in touch with the school, and I was given permission to be off school. Same with my sisters as well. They had the same thing happen with them. Now that sort of, in a way, it sort of broke me through secondary school. So doing that, although I did see a future in what I wanted to do, I always knew that I wanted to be either entertainment, TV, media, I needed to be in that environment.
Yeah.
But just throughout my secondary school, that sort of broke me, had doing that, because of the negativity that I was receiving from everyone else. When I went back, if I had a week off, if I was filming for a week or shooting for a week, and then I went back to school, the negativity that I'd get from people, or people think, oh, you know, trying to make out like I was being cocky. I was never like that. People got the wrong idea about me very, you know, quite soon. And still to this day, actually, people do get they have the wrong impression of me.
I certainly don't see you like that. You're very humble and career driven, which is, I think, is admirable. Mm. But certainly not cocky. When... I suppose, where did it start going wrong for you?
It started going wrong. So I left school and I went into, like, all my mates. We all sort of went into the motor. I was always heavily involved with motocross and off-roading and stuff like that. That, again, was a big passion of mine. So my immediate thought was, or my initial thought was, motor mechanics. So I went into the motor mechanic trade, and I lasted, Christ, how long did I do? 4 months.
Okay.
So it wasn't my best option, to be honest with you. But
why did it last so short?
I was very sort of flitty. It wasn't what I wanted to do. I always knew where I wanted to go. I always knew it. I had no idea how to get to where I wanted to be, but I knew where I wanted to go, and that was mainstream. I wanted to be. I was always the entertainer, the performer, the front man. I was always that, and I never had to put it on. I was never putting it on. It was just me. It's just who I was. And I wasn't fulfilled doing it. Any job. I haven't been fulfilled doing any job that hasn't been entertainment sort of based.
Yeah.
I sort of, at a young age, sort of young 20s, I got into, I started doing performing arts in Cambridge. So I'd done a performing arts, or started a performing arts degree. And then I found cocaine. So that is where coke came into my life. About 18 years old.
So performing arts. I mean, I've done some acting. I was in a film called Cocaine. Have you seen it?
No.
No, I only had one line.
How long knock we got it, here?
Knocking them out today. Knocking them out. So so you're at, was it a performing arts?
It was performing arts college, yeah, in Cambridge.
And so someone introduced you to cocaine.
Yeah.
What was it like?
Incredible.
How did you feel?
I mean, that first, that very first line, like, I was anxious. I was really nervous because it wasn't pushed on me. Don't get me wrong, but I'd had a drink, and obviously, you know, when you drink, your mind starts going elsewhere, and
we press you that become fuck it button, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, and you start, like you say, just couldn't give a shit now. So yeah, I'd done it, and it probably was to this day probably the best feeling of my life.
Identify. Identify. It's funny because when I do, I used to do a lot of talks at schools, and I mentioned this on a previous episode, and it's, I don't go into schools and tell them how bad drugs are because they don't want to hear that. No, they don't believe it. They're being told about, you know, from their friends about how amazing it is. They're not going to listen to me coming in. No. Telling, I tell them how good they are.
Yeah.
But the consequences that follow from it.
From it, yeah, 100%, 100%. I've always said that as well. Excuse me. I've always said to people, like, the feeling that I get or that I got from using, I'm going to miss it. I do miss it. Yeah, I do.
Do you feel that you were searching for that feeling?
I was always, yeah, I was always trying to feel something. And what I learned, in about myself when I went into rehab was, it's that void. And because I had so many years of knowing where I wanted to go, but not quite getting there. And it wasn't, I didn't quite cut it. I didn't quite, you know. And I spent my life, you know, before I went to performing arts college, I spent my life in these dead-end jobs or not committed to them or not. I was just going, basically, to keep my family off my back. So I was getting up in the morning and going to work. So otherwise they were going, well, you need to go and get a job. And I couldn't be doing with that. And that was stressing me out and getting on my tits. But going to, it was literally filling an emptiness, filling the void till I went into rehab. It's exactly what I was doing. It was.
So you took your first line of cocaine. What did the rest of that day kind of look like?
It was an evening. I remember exactly where it was and where it was, and when it was as well. It was a house party in Cambridge. We'd been for drinks after college. Then we went back to the house party, and that was the first time I tried it in a toilet on a second floor of a townhouse near the train station in Cambridge. And I remember it very well. I remember exactly who I was with. I haven't thought about that since you asked that question. I haven't thought about the first time, and that's just now just suddenly gone and just remembered.
Brings it right back, doesn't
yeah.
it? So let's get rid of that good memory. Yeah. Let's see let's see about what it looked like after that day.
Right.
So what happened kind of moving forward?
Right, so moving forward from there, it was obviously that feeling of euphoria.
Yeah.
And that the dopamine rush was obviously I loved it. So what happened is from there, every weekend I would use. Didn't start off by buying it, but I always knew the people to be around if I wanted to use it.
And they give you, yeah.
Yeah, let's have a lot of pins. A coin or a corner or a line or key or whatever. And and I could do it. I could, to be fair, a line, a couple of lines on a Friday night, I was fine. Then go get something to eat, go home, go to bed. Do that, done that for a couple of, probably about a year, I reckon I'd done that. In between that time, I was sort of buying maybe a little half or something like that. But after that year is when I started. That was then regular for me. So that was became part of my life. And I started planning my nights around picking up first.
What do you feel it was doing for you at that time that you couldn't do for yourself?
It was still filling that void, still filling that emptiness. But what I thought, what I believed it was doing, was making me who I was when I was back at school. So when I was always very outgoing, always, like I said, the performer, the chatty one, the life and soul of the party, always described as that. But when I was bullied through school, I think I lost a bit of that of me. So what I was doing was, with the coke, boosting my confidence. And
you're becoming that old Nathan
becoming
again.
Becoming, getting that back again, yeah.
So it's interesting. So you lost that kind of spark.
I believed I lost that spark.
Yeah.
I will tell you something interesting shortly, actually. But yeah, I believed I lost that spark. And it was giving me the confidence again to be able to talk to people, to be able to feel that, just that little bit better about me. Yeah.
And it's interesting because I think there's stages with addiction, and it does for us what we can't do for ourselves, or what we think we can't do for ourselves. So where did that change for you?
How do you mean?
So for first year, you're using weekends, Friday nights.
Yep.
It's filling that void. It's giving you that confidence that you thought you may have lost, that spark. Where did it start to go
spiral
after that? Where did it start to spiral?
Probably three years in, I started realising that I started lying about using.
Interesting.
So I was, don't get me wrong, I was always very honest about, if people had said to me, I was very open with my family and stuff, and I always said that I'd done it, that I'd tried it. I never let on that I was going, like how much I was, you know, how often I was using and stuff like that, but I was always very honest to begin with about it. But then when I started lying, when people were asking me, did you do coke that night? And I started saying, no. Or, you know, when I found, it's a really tricky one that, because I know where I've gone wrong with it. And I knew when it was becoming a problem was because of the lying. And eventually, when I was lying to my family and friends about it, it got to a point where I couldn't afford to fund my habit. So I ended up stealing from them. So stealing from my mum, my dad, like going through the purse. And it could be little things. Like it could have even been, I need £3 for a pack of fags.
Yeah.
But it's just, the point is that I was taking from my family and from my friends to go and to feed, because I'd spent money on gear and I didn't have money for anything else. So I had to, I felt so ashamed, because I think people get the wrong idea about addiction and people in addiction. I never done anything to hurt anyone. I've always been a very loving, caring, kind, giving person. And I always have been that. I've been brought up like that. When I was taken from my family or taken from my friends, it was never about hurting them. It was never about, I'm doing this. I would have loved to have been in myself. I would have loved to have been able to say, please can I borrow some money? Because I need some fat. But I couldn't. I felt so guilty, so shameful. The resentment.
Did you feel that would open up a line of kind of interrogation in any way? Where's your money gone? Anything like that?
Yeah. Yeah, it would have done. Well, where, yeah, that conversation's been, that was had when I was younger, that was had many, many times. Yeah. Well, what have you done with it? You had this much then. Obviously, I knew where it had gone. Got on coke. But it was, it brings back a lot for me, because I put, with regards to the lying and stuff, and I'm not a liar. Nathan King, isn't a liar. I'm not a liar.
Good plug.
I'm not a liar. And I'm not a thief. However, my addiction got me. Yeah, it made me into that person. But unfortunately, for a long time, and that with my sisters growing up, that is what they saw. You know, from a young age to sort of, you know, up until, I don't know, a few years ago now. But that's how they know me. They know me as that person. You know.
Do they trust you now?
Yeah. Now my life has completely flipped. Because they've always known the real me, They have known the real me because I have been sober for a period of time. I haven't used, you know, there have been times where I haven't used for a certain, and I get me back for a few days and then bang, I'm up again. But so they do know that. Obviously, it's very frustrating. It must be very frustrating. I haven't been on the receiving end of addiction. No, I haven't. I've been, you know, in the addiction, but it has been very frustrating and it's broken them. It completely broken them. I stole all of their peace of minds.
And that's the thing. Addiction doesn't just bring you down. It brings everyone else around you down. So at your worst, how much would you say that you were spending a week or a month on cocaine?
At my worst, 300 a day.
It's a serious amount of money.
Yeah, at my worst, 300 a day. I've done a 4-month stint of 300 a day. I had a few times where I was doing half an ounce a day. I'd done a couple of them, where I was getting gear to get rid of, and I thought the old classic, well, I'll try a bit first.
We don't make the best dealers.
No, definitely
that's not. That's for sure.
The worst experience of my life. Sat in a van from 6 in the evening till 7 in the morning, driving around the same village. Just driving around and parking up. With half ounce, 14 grams for anyone that doesn't know. But yeah, so I sat there with 14 grams of cocaine and just sniffed a lot.
Or 50 grams if you're cutting it really badly.
You know. But I was just, it was, you know, that paranoia and stuff. I'm sure you can relate to that, the paranoia. I was driving, I sat there and then suddenly I think I can see a light coming through a bush. So I jumped out, kept on jumping out the van and going ducking in bushes and stuff, hiding there. And
driving at night on cocaine, every car behind you is a police car. Every car. I get that. Think how I felt being in the police.
Crikey. You know,
being in a police station, walking past yourself in a mirror in a uniform.
Your anxiety must have been through the roof.
Honestly, not a healthy mix. I do not recommend it to any police officers out there. I get that. So what point was it that struck, that made you think, you know what, enough's enough?
There wasn't one.
Interesting.
There wasn't one. Tail end of last year, September, me and my ex-partner, we went for a breakup. And I sat for 4 months. This is when I was using at my heaviest, like, as in over a period of time.
Yeah.
So I sat for 4 months doing an 8-ball a day. I was still functioning. I was still going to work, but I was waking up. With the hour sleep that I was getting, I was waking up, sniffing, doing a line, go down to work. I'd have probably a bacon roll if I could manage it, and then that would be my food intake for the day. Copious amounts of coffee, and then probably by about 10 o'clock, I'd be back on the bag again. All the way through, pick up. So, like I said, pick up at 10-ish, and then finish my day at 3-4. Pick up again at 4:30, ready for the evening. So that then took me up to December 2020, when I owed some money to a dealer. I spoke to one of my brother-in-laws and spoke to him about it. Not because I wanted help for me. I was worried about the consequences.
How much did you owe?
It wasn't about 700 quid. So a quarter.
Which is a lot of money when you got no money.
A lot of money when you got no money and you sold everything else for gear. Because I went through that 4 months, I sold my Range Rover, motocross bikes, recording equipment I use for work, a lot of designer clothes, all to get, you know, I was getting a lot of cash in and it was all just going bang, bang, coke, coke, coke. And then by the end of it, I got to a point and I didn't have anything else. I had nothing else to get rid of.
Yeah.
Didn't have anything. I'd exhausted all avenues of borrowing. Work wasn't paying enough. And obviously the more I was getting into it, the less I was going to work, or less I was able to do at work. Because I was just a mess. I'd lost so much weight. I was just, gaunt, just black and it's horrible. And then I spoke to my brother-in-law and I said, I really need to get something paid because I'm worried about what's going to happen to me if not. And he came back to me and he said, first of all, typical addict, I said, please don't tell anyone else. Well, obviously, the first thing he done was told my sister.
Good.
100%. And he said, I've had to tell her because I don't lie to him. And I was just like, this is just normal. You know what I mean? Like, these people are just normal people and they haven't deserved me to be doing this. And yeah, then he got back to me and he said, I'm only going to pay it if you go to rehab. So I was...
So he gave you that ultimatum.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I had no choice. I had to do it. I had to go... I knew, you know, don't get me wrong, I knew over the years what I'd done. I knew what I'd lost. I knew what hurt I'd caused people. And I knew it had to change. I was going nowhere.
And this this is a perfect example, and I preach this a lot. Excuse me. There's this old school mentality that you've got to be shouting off the rooftops that you're desperate for help, right, in order to get it. It's not the case.
No.
You know, sometimes an ultimatum needs to happen.
Yeah.
Because look, it's proven.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah, 100%.
You know?
Either, yeah, get the help. Like I say this to, you know, people now, it is that ultimatum. You either get help or you get out of my house. That's the two choices. When it gets to a point and you can't have, you know, I was enabled. My family were enabling me for many years with bailing me out.
And that's very common.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I completely understand that. But it does. It had to come to that. It had to come to the right. These are your two options. This is all you've got left. I will pay that for you. The very last thing, I will pay that for you. But you have to go into rehab. It's as simple as that. Those are the two options. I can pay it. You go to rehab. Or I don't pay it, and you sort it out yourself.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very grateful for him for doing that for me. Like. That from that point onwards changed my life.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. So you went into rehab.
Yeah.
You were there for 28 days?
28 days.
What's recovery like?
I didn't realise I was an addict. I knew I loved coke. I knew I loved that feeling. I didn't realise I was an addict because I'd never looked into what is addiction or anything like that. I'd never looked into it. I just knew that I loved the feeling, how coke made me feel.
I didn't. I just loved the smell of it.
The smell of
it. Another joke. Another joke.
God.
There we are.
Can we add a hi-hat in there? I think, day two of rehab is when I realised that I was an addict. From that point, the relating to people... like the shares, the stories, and thinking, oh my fucking God, this person is literally the mirror image of me. They're saying exactly what I used to do, what they, in their story, and this person is an addict. That I've done exactly the same as that. I must be an addict. The more I was speaking to people, relating to other people's stories, was when I thought, shit,
that's where
this is me.
Shocking.
And then it went. Bang.
Which is why I'm a really big advocate on group therapy for that exact reason.
Yeah.
Because our heads would tell us, you know, I remember, and you just brought a really, really powerful memory back. I remember being in a meeting and I was questioning, am I an addict? And someone said, I was laying in bed, looking at the ceiling for hours on end, saying, I am never, ever, ever doing this again. And meaning it with every fibre on my body. Wake up in the morning and do it again.
Yeah.
And I thought, shit, I do that most nights.
Yeah.
You know? And I really, really identify. I think, God, it's not just me that does that. And I suppose this is how Alcoholics Anonymous started. You know, this was Dr. Bob, Bill W., two alcoholics, from what I can recall, sitting around table talking about their drinking stories.
Yeah.
And realised that, hold on, they've not had a drink. Yeah. Two alcoholics, not had a drink all night. And they felt that they realised that the power here is addicts coming together.
Yeah, 100%. And there's something so special about that. That is something. There's something so magical, so powerful about a group of addicts together. That vulnerability.
Yeah.
It's just insane. In rehab, like doing telling my life story, the experiences and stuff that I had whilst using. And like breaking down in front of a group of 20 people that I've never met. I don't know who they are. You know what I mean? Like day three, I think I'd done my life story. I didn't know them. And I was just broken down. And it's, you know, it's a scary, scary thought. And a really emotional time. Rehab isn't easy, is it? I mean, rehab is not easy. You go in, it will change you. If you're ready to stop, rehab will change you. But it isn't just that you go in and you come out and it's all done. That doesn't work like that. It's an emotional, brutal. I mean, I describe it as being brutal. And it was, for my personal experience of rehab was brutal. Like, I was really broke down to when I was a child, like my real core, and then built back up again. And I learned so much. Everything. I owe everything I've got today to my program, to rehab. I do. To my family as well.
So, you got an amazing presence on social media. You're helping loads of people on social media, which is obviously what I try and do as well. So what happens now?
What happens now for you, Kingy? I'm like, my past, like I said, my past, my previous history has always been entertainment. I've done 17 years in the entertainment industry. And my passion has always been people, and to entertain people. So TV was always my natural route. That was always my route to go down to present, or something along those lines anyway, no pun intended.
Oh, you're coming back. Yeah, he's coming learning, back.
Learning. there's a few things going on for me at the minute, which is exciting. I've got back as well. Like, I lost agents years ago throughout using. I've done some filming and stuff on BBC for a few different shows, and I ballsed a lot of stuff up. I didn't show up on my call times and stuff because I'd got on it the night before, and I lost agents. Since I've come out of rehab, those agents I didn't reach out to them. They got back in touch with me.
Amazing.
And since then, I've done four or five different jobs with them in the last couple of months. Like, big new things coming up next year. And I'm trying to pursue or trying to push for presenting. I need to get my show reel and stuff like that done and get myself out there properly. Because it was always sort of half-heartedly. I was waiting for someone to come and knock on the door and go, hello, mate, do you want a job on the TV? That's what I was waiting for.
Doesn't quite happen.
It doesn't work like that. But I have to say, with what I'm doing and the way it's going, it's been like, it's not just a coincidence. It's not just a coincidence that I've done what I'm doing. I work very hard. Don't get me wrong. It's not just, again, these things aren't just coming to me on a plate. I work very hard every single day at my recovery, at helping others with my social media, whatever I'm doing. So, and it isn't just a coincidence that I've removed the stuff out of my life that needed to get out of my life. And suddenly this law of attraction starts working, kicking in. These things start coming your way.
Big believer in that. I think we're creative people. You know, we can find ways of getting money that you wouldn't, you know, other people wouldn't. We're hardworking, because addiction is not for lazy people.
Addiction is the most exhausting thing. Keeping on top of lies, keeping on top of when's the next bag coming from? Yep. Why isn't it here? What am I going to do tonight? Who am I going to hide this from? What am I going to...
And like I explained, it's that Rubik's Cube. It is constantly shuffling.
You're constantly moving stuff. Yeah, exactly. Brilliant, actually.
Is constantly like that.
That's probably the most intelligent thing you've said.
I'm probably not. I'm not going to disagree. Yeah, I won't disagree with that at all. I mean, I think the passion there is amazing. And I think this is what recovery is about. You're living it now. Mm. And you're going for your dreams. And I think, recovery isn't doom and gloom. You know, no. If you want doom and gloom, go back to using.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, recovery is about having fun.
I can't remember. I now wake up in the morning and I smile. The first thing I do is smile. And I do, genuinely, hand on my heart. Which side's your heart?
If I look like you, I probably would smile as well. Yeah.
First thing I do is smile. And then obviously go for a walk. But I've never done that. I've never, ever, since I was a youngster, and I mean 18 years ago, I haven't done that. And I live every single day. It's just like, I now walk around. I live in Cambridge. And I walk around just looking up at, I must look like a right nutter. Because I walk around just like looking up at buildings. And I just, things like this, walking around the same, I say this a lot, walk around the same streets as I do now, as I did back then off my head. I walk around them now and I'm just like, how the fucking hell have I not seen this?
You're present.
It's amazing. Like, amazing. It's incredible.
And if you, and this is one question I love asking every guest. So to anyone watching, feel free to speak to them directly, that's in addiction and wanting to make that transition into recovery, what one tip would you give them?
first thing what I will say is there is a very fine line.
No pun intended.
No pun intended again. There's a very fine line between using and being clean, right? All it is, that tiny, tiny little step. Now, at the minute, if you're in addiction, you will be feeling like you can't do anything with it, that you're stuck in it, it's nothing's going to change. You're on your own. You're the only one that feels like this. You're not. Now, to go from feeling like that to this is a very fine line, but the second you are honest, the second you speak about it, a big weight's just going to go, as what we do, what I've done for years and years and years, we just let things build up. My head was like a washing machine. Most addicts can relate to that. Just things going, blah, 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 100 miles an hour all the time. And the second I was honest, the second I was real with it, was just weights just started falling off gently. And then before you know it, you're honest about that thing. Hang on a minute, I don't have to lie. What do I need to lie about? I'll be honest about that. And before you know it, you've got nothing to lie about.
It's freeing.
Yeah, completely. It really is. So it would be to I've sort of rambled on a little bit there, Nick. That might would be honest.
I think it's a brilliant message. I think it's important. And it's hard because my default setting is to lie.
Yeah.
Over 12 years now. Still is. I have to work.
Yeah.
I have to work on it. You know, and it's not easy sometimes, but, you know, it's freeing. Mm. And then you haven't got to worry about, because I can't, I am a shit liar.
I think we all are. I think in addiction, people know what you're doing. Have you used? No.
I
liar.
Always get caught out.
Always
get caught
the
out.
The worst. And I think, yeah, as soon as you start being honest, start being real, and it is difficult. I completely get that. In addiction, I was terrible. I was compulsively lying. And it wasn't just around using, because obviously it stems out. It's difficult to keep up what you've told to different people, and you're trying to keep up with it all. And you now I can't be caught out. No one can catch me out now. There's nothing to, I've got nothing to slip up on, yeah, because I've been honest. Ever since rehab, during rehab, I started that transition,
yeah,
of ringing people up and apologising, saying, yeah, I did do that. Yeah, I did take that. I started that transition in rehab, and I haven't told any lies. I've got, no one can come back at me now. Everything I've obviously gone onto social media, at Official Nathan King. I've gone onto social media and told my story. I've said everything I've done. No one can come back at me. I'm not, you know, people, obviously you're going to get people that try and add a little bit more onto the story and stuff. It's not true, but I've been very openly honest. I didn't have to, but I have been.
We can't control others, but we can control ourselves.
Exactly.
I think, Nathan, thank you so much.
Nick, thank you ever so much. Can we do that?
We can do it.
Oh, we can. Can we? Thank you ever so much. You. Really appreciate it. Thank
Loved
you.
Coming on. Oh. It's a wrap.
It's a wrap.
Great, great, great session. Right? Thank you. Loved it.
Good. Really enjoyed it.